You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry. I'm your host, David Gilmore. This is Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM. And I'm very happy to have with us today a celebrity, an entrepreneur of poetry, Paul E. Nelson. Some of you may know of Paul from events that you have attended. Welcome, Paul, to Sound Poetry. And I haven't mentioned any of your works, which are very, very extensive, but you may talk about some of those because they fit into your fairly recent poetic experience over the last 20 years or so. I'm glad to have you on Sound Poetry. So listen up, folks, you got an earful coming.
You say the book, and you're obviously referring to the book that's in front of you.
Yes, I am.
Haibun de la Serna, which is a book of 99 haibun. Haibun is a medieval Japanese form invented by Basho with dense poetic prose and, in Basho's case, a haiku. In my case, a haiku-like moment. I don't think they're real official haikus, but they're three-line poems and they're epigrammatic, and they will often end the haibun, or they'll be in the middle of it, or sometimes there'll be two. I played around with the form, and you know, when you write 99 of something, you get a chance to mess around with it. But this one is number 30. This actually won the Robin Blazer Award, I believe, in 2014 by the Capilano Review. So I'll read this. 30, the day the weather decided to die, after a Haida tale told by Robert Bringhurst, with an epigraph, as in all the haibun in this book, an epigraph by Ramon Gomez de la Serna. On hearing the wooden rumble of thunder, we realize that we are situated below the platform of the sky. What constitutes a good family, they say, and give instructions to servants under the backdrop of the hugest sucking sound in history, prelude to when the wind did no longer rumble from under the skirt of the great Ma, no longer float a blue heron's hajo-side lumber, no longer sustain. Age of celebrity tattoo news, or the rise of the Yurok, Duwamish, Tsimshian, Haida, Puyallup, Muckleshoot, Musqueam, of tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, tsunamis, bee silence, Fukushima, and Fukushima's to come. The weather born out of cockleshell embryo or out of snot. Weather that hunts birds and sends winds out in the skins of blue jay. Weather that steals hats of campesinos, compassions, for kicks. Weather that would sprout houses when adopted by a master carver. Weather that would be a scholar of carving. The weather, when painted, would sit facing the sea, would weep for owls with spots in the new northward range of Dolphin's neighborhood, weather that would warn of the big ones who think of biting, weather whose big fish story is dried halibut and waits and waits and waits and waits and waits for a shift in settler rituals. It could start with today is a good day to die, could start with the inheritance of the campesino, compression, who opened up about his daily prayers for humility, or when he, the one born in a cockleshell, would dress as wren and sit way above the sea as a cumulus cloud, waiting to see what his latihan would bring, dance, song, chant, or something more cathartic just beyond his outstretched wings. Remember, crows, your brother, stumps, never lie. We hold up the sky. There's a crow poem for you right there, right off the bat.
There is, but there is also a full version of the haiku, haibun epigrammatic pattern that is part of most of the book, but not all will follow this pattern. And as Paul mentioned, the middle section is largely written as prose, but comes across quite clearly in arch poetic phrases that don't always seem syntactically apt, but that's because there's an unconscious element, I would say, that you felt when you did this, what, spontaneously?
The need for syntax in a situation like this is lower than the need to somehow transmit the energy that was experienced in the moment I sat down to write the poem. And so after reading this Robert Bringhurst, his version of a Haida story, I was moved to write this. And then I found the best quote from Ramon Gomez de la Serna. He wrote these poems called Gregarillas, or aphorisms.
Right.
And Pablo Baller, who teaches at Cal State LA, said that my American sentences reminded him of Gregarillas. And so that started an exploration of Ramon Gomez de la Serna, who was a friend of Salvador Dalí, and they collaborated on a book together. So you take all this together, and this was, you know, roughly a third into this series of Haibun, which were written over the span of about 3 years. And that's what came out. And so you feel the energy when you feel you're on a roll and you're getting a quick take and you're writing consistently with the practice of outside, that you trust the language as it's appearing to you in your mind, syllable by syllable. And you don't worry necessarily about sense or if someone else would understand or even if you understand. Because I've had the experience, I write something and I don't really understand what it means until about 5 years later, and then something happens, and I'm like, oh, so that's what they were talking about.
Mm. In your oral pre-written form, before you put it down and make sentences with periods, and there is punctuation throughout this, even though, does the rhythm then that you start out with, the sort of metrical movement of it, get you going into whatever the subject and idea might be that it forms?
Yeah, the rhythm is dictated as it goes along in my head as I'm hearing it, appearing syllable by syllable. And in other work that I do, and in a story that was told about Charles Olson, Charles Olson wrote an essay called Projective Verse, and in it he said that since the advent of the typewriter, the poet has the ability to use the page as a score for how the poem should be read. So when it's a prose poem like this, I tend to, I mean, it's prose, so you can keep reading, and that propels the energy when you're reading this more with these very, very long lines the width of the page. So it's not just the rhythm of it, but it's also with me in particular, mostly the sound of the syllables, the assonance.
Yes. And those syllables, when they follow one another, do form sometimes a clear metrical kind of rhythm. And these are poems of momentum, largely, I think, sometimes never coming to an end of it for quite some number of lines, which I felt that I thought, is there going to be a stop to this as I continue to cast my eyes over it? And so that is a problem for you, where to stop sometimes, is it not?
Well, fortunately, there's a period every now and then. I mean, in these poems, there's a period, there's a comma. Yeah. Sometimes use space rather than a comma.
Right,
The space, really, I began to experiment with that before I knew about the essay Projective Verse, when I was a newscaster and I was creating news scripts. And so to give myself space or a little warning, read this slowly because it's difficult to articulate.
All right.
You know, I might give two spaces between words. And so no one's going to read these scripts later. I'm going to throw them in the recycle bin or throw them away. And so it was a little cue to me as to how to best read them. And then later when I came across Projective Verse, I started thinking, I was doing that as a newscaster, scoring it on the page as it should be read.
Right.
And then the other part about it is when you have a blank page, rather than have it conventionally, everything on a left-hand margin, you have the whole page to work with. So Michael McClure warned about what he called lawnmower poetry, where it's, you know, it starts on the left margin, goes to the right, and then you could kind of come back and go up from the right to the left, and the lines on the page look as if the same way in which somebody mows a lawn. So I wanted to get away from that and take advantage of the possibilities that a blank page would give you.
There definitely was a style of that in ancient and some Aboriginal poems or lines where they do actually go from the end and go backwards like that, which is a really interesting trip on the eyes when you first see one.
Or like reading Hebrew, where it's right to left.
Yes, that's right, opposite way. Well, read another one. I like that one, Clues, that has the anaphora of the word clue many, many times in it. That might be an interesting one because of the use of your clues.
Yeah, and this was written at the lake, which was the final home of the great Northwest painter Morris Graves. And I was fortunate enough to do a residency there because Morris was good friends with Sam Hamill. And Sam, before he died, hooked me up with it. I ended the book with poems written at the lake, ended this particular book, and there's part of another book that I wrote there. So there are three phrases in here that I got from the letters of Morris Graves, the collected letters. I will try and indicate that with a pause and with my voice, because if you can't see it, you're not sure. And for you, I could do the air quotes thing.
are they sometimes the italicized phrases you've chosen from perhaps another verse, a verse of someone else?
Well, from the letters. They were from the letters. Of Morris Graves. From there the like go. Into the day, moon, little sweet, a sweet little nosegay like, and great cobwebs of geese in the sky.
Yeah.
Those were the three. So now you'll know when they come up. Clues from Hell, epigraph, Ramon Gomez de la Serna, smoke rises to heaven when it ought to descend to hell. And the heavens of your making a home, be it the rock or Caerlaudon, Woodtown or the lake, Cagayan or Cloud Nine, Slaughter, or a little corner of Hillman City survivable by pea patch. Make it with enough care to notice, from the lichen to the day moon, from the library to the Japanese maple, from the giant sunflowers to the three steepled cedar points to better weather. In it, and in the chaos of the marked-up books, the three-toed vase, the empty Otokoyama bottles in the recycle bin, clues. To sift through the wreckage one day, they'll want clues. Clues to how you ended up next to a fire, well tended, and clues to the spiritual chase. Clues to the record and direction for future seekers, and clues to where you hid the humbled fog. Clues could hide right in front of you, as does the sponge plant by the duckweed drift which smears the morning lake. Clues of cigarette butts and grief. Old-growth redwood, 800 years old, 300 feet tall, heard its share of prayers. They were always there, we'll say, prominent as miniature islands with salal, blue huckleberry, and dwarfed spruce, calm as the lake ripples made by a kootflock landing, subtle as the wood smoke rejecting hell in the making of its new home as it courts the morning Cascadia fog, sincere as autumn bouquets, sweet little nosegay-like, for every dead stranger in the cemetery, made with the spirit of great cobwebs of geese in the sky and mild-mannered hallucinations of reverse snow in September Olympic fireweed or the hush of dropping fir needles with each new exhale from Blue Glacier. So, stock up on cake mix and tequila, butter and turkey bacon, mangoes y pan de banana. Have handy jasmine, rice, and altar candles, fresh garlic and olive oil, cashew bits and blush wine, wool socks and binoculars, photos of the loved ones, and always the clue-enabling ancestors. Decoding the sea and the heavens ain't for sissies. Lend a hand or stand back. And that notion of decoding the sea and the heavens ain't for sissies is also from Morris Graves.
Mm. So did you ever hear Morris Graves speak, or did you just know of his work from pictures that he drew and painted and from his notebooks then?
Yeah, his paintings And I went to an event when a book came out. I think it might have been the Collected Letters. I think I went on that occasion and attended that reading. And then when I was at the lake, a copy of the letters was there. And so I mined it. And in this case, there's the personal mythology of Morris Graves and my own personal myth with Otoyama, which is a sake that Sam Hamill preferred and I enjoyed on many occasions with Sam. And you'll quite often find at your average sushi bar, they'll often have Otokoyama. It's a very popular sake and a very tasty one. And other things about my own personal myth. I don't drink a lot of tequila anymore, but I don't know, for some reason cake mix and tequila went together. I've never baked a cake, so I don't know how those came in. Maybe those were items that were in the pantry there at the lake. I don't remember. Certainly turkey bacon, lots of butter, mangoes, banana bread. Yeah, all those things. Absolutely.
If you heard a sort of interruption with staccato lines, this is one of the pages that has a haiku-like segment in the middle, as well as at the end, which is not the common kind of placement, but in this one, it might have been picked up with the old-growth redwood.
Morris Graves is buried, his ashes are buried at that redwood. And so either I found that out and made sure I was going to bring attention to that moment of the poem, or I wrote it like that and later found out that his ashes were buried there, because it was pretty poignant. And, you know, just to be in a place where there are these ancient trees is a pretty remarkable thing in our day, in our time, when, trees are commodities and are being clear cut.
Morris Graves and his ashes. Graves, his name really fits his imagery in his pictures. The solemnity and grayness of them, the gravity of the image, something morbid and deathly about the imagery with the bird barely alive or the dead bird. It's as though he were attuned to grayness.
He was a native Cascadian. So, I also think that being a gay man in the middle of the 20th century was probably a very difficult task. Yeah. And Sam loved to tell a story about how he invited all the critics, the Seattle art critics, to his home. I think it was The Rock, or was Kerladen, maybe The Rock, on Fidalgo Island. And he set up a very nice banquet for them and left and then turned on the sprinklers and wet them all. So he, I think there was some, there was some anger there as he strove to be a Zen master. And, you know, being able to go to the lake is a real gift because there's not a lot of people who see that. And the foundation is very careful about who gets to do a residency there. So I feel very fortunate, and I think that these poems have strength in large part because of the combination of me being at the end of this series of 99 poems and having a place to write at, like the lake, which is just remarkable. You write in his studio, the place where he created the paintings the last 30 years of his life. So it was pretty remarkable.
You will hear Paul mention poetic personages that of great note, Sam Hamill. Northwesterner?
He was born in Northern California, was the son of an illiterate carnival fry cook, and given up for adoption so that he could learn how to read by a Mormon family who then abused him physically. And so he became a juvenile delinquent and stealing cars and getting hooked on heroin and being involved in prostitution. And Kenneth Rexroth saw him outside of City Lights and said, you know, what are you doing? Come over to my house and I'll cook you a decent meal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he convinced Sam that, you know, he was never going to be anything addicted to heroin. And helped him get clean, and then may have encouraged him. I don't know if Rex Roth did or not, but it's possible that Rex Roth encouraged him to join the Marines. And he joined the Marines, became a conscientious objector, and made a bodhisattva vow to poetry. Went back to school at Cal State, or it was Santa Barbara. I don't know if that's Cal State, Santa Barbara. Studied with Hugh Kenner, who wrote The Pound Era, so he was very familiar with Ezra Pound. And he and a couple of other folks that he was involved with won a contest of the best college press in the country, and they took that check and started Copper Canyon Press in Colorado. And then circa 1972 or 3, maybe 74, did residency at Centrum, and Copper Canyon Press is still at Centrum. And Sam left the press about 10 years before his death, but, you know, published a great deal of work in terms of his own work, in terms of his translations, in terms of brilliant essays that are incredibly underrated. And he, you know, he dedicated his life to poetry and took a bodhisattva vow of poverty to do this. And so he was a great teacher to me. I have a lot of respect for him.
Well, having carnivals at his in his genes, so to speak, it's no wonder that he had a life so well, fantastic in many ways, right? It's quite an unusual career. But did you meet him many times then?
Yeah, Sam and I were friends, drank a lot of sake, and had a lot of sushi dinners. He wrote a very nice blurb for me in 2014, part of which I think goes on the back of this book. He knew about the Haibun, and I'm his literary executor. So
he died a few years ago.
He died on April 14th, 2018 at 6 p.m.
Right. So as you speak of these very unusual writers who've written novels as well as poetry and have had really interesting checkered lives, going up and down the scale, sometimes in vitality and maybe even into morbid phases. The beats that you did Hamill get attracted to the beats?
Yeah, when he was a young man hanging out at City Lights, he wanted to be Kerouac, but as he paid more attention to Rex Roth. Rex Roth, I'll probably paraphrase this quote, but someone asked him if he was a beat, and he said, "An entomologist is not a bug." It was his famous response to that. And so I think Sam began to get a taste for something that went a little deeper than typical beat stuff, which of course became a cliche after a while. You know, Dobie Gillis, for example, a TV show in the early 60s with Bob Denver playing Maynard Krebs and making fun of beatniks. On one hand, you know, on the other hand, they were just way ahead of the culture. They were pacifists. They, you know, they didn't like the 50s U.S.-American mentality. And Michael McClure, who has a foot in the beat world and a foot in the Black Mountain world, I think is the best example of both of those movements. So Sam knew about the beats when he was younger, wanted to be one, but then I think he was more interested in Japanese culture, in Zen, in translations, and in really finding a place and loving it.
Some of the Rex Roth influence definitely might have been towards the Asian and the Buddhist. Rex Roth was a translator of Chinese, right?
100 poems from the Chinese. I think he also did a poem from the Japanese, you know, book of poems from the Japanese. And yes, was very much ahead of the curve.
And he stayed out of the beat movement, more or less. He was on the fringes of it and connected with the personalities, but really didn't indulge himself.
Didn't consider him a beat. He did not want to be considered a beat poet. But he was also friends with, you know, the other side in San Francisco at the time, you know, the Spicer Circle, Jack Spicer, Robin Blazer, and then Robert Duncan. I mean, Duncan Blaser and Spicer were the Berkeley Renaissance. So they were ahead of the Beats in San Francisco and sort of laid the ground for it, as did Rex Roth, laying the ground for it, and other people like Helen Adam and and you know, you could go on and on. Joanne Kiger, George Stanley, and later Diane DePrima, and others. So yeah, Rex Roth was there, active in anarchist circles. He was in Chicago during the Jazz Age. So he seemed to be in the right place at the right time when there was something very rich happening culturally.
One of your poems is dedicated to Hamill, Sam Hamill. Do you want to read that one?
There's a book that we did for the 2019 Cascadia Poetry Fest, which was staged in Anacortes, the town that Sam lived in for the last 9 or so years of his life. And it's a very interesting, this might tie a couple of threads together. It's not a haibun, but it's in the book that we put out called Samthology, a tribute to Sam Hamill.
All right, yes, I noticed that one. Who published the Samthology?
We published this through what we were calling Seattle Poetics Lab. We don't call ourselves the Seattle Poetics Lab anymore. We're the Cascadia Poetics Lab. So this remains sort of a relic.
A website, CascadiaPoeticsLab.org. O-R-G. Yeah. .org.
Yeah, this is... I'll read you the poem and I'll tell you the technique, which has a great Sam story. Letter to Sam Hamill. Dear Sam, when I searched the past for you, you'd not be Basho sleeping next to pissing horses or Levi dead drunk reaching for the full moon's reflection. You can rarely see the Cascadia moon, and you're more a sea guy than a man about rivers. Leave that for Sund and his friends. More measured than falling for that old reflection trick, though his moon lunge might have been the equivalent of Kevorkian in Tang era Xi'an, and the boots remain muddy. How Rex Roth's alive inside you, the last first guy here looking east. I think about how you love to tell stories, and I'm always happy to set you up. Take long, tall Dexter at Centrum. They're going to play scales even if they're the master class. How that phrase reverberates with the unwillingness to humble oneself. Ah, poor Townsend. Will you visit there after your last taste of cold Otokoyama? Return as a whisper in the poplars of Cape George or leading the Congress of Trees? We're still digesting your last will and testimony, your final habitation. I thought it was your Zen golf concentration with which you screened out backswing distractions. But no, just your hearing aid turned off. How, at Avalon, you'll watch the eagles, know a baby eagle as it flies overhead, while you shoot for birdies after a good drive, or settle for a layup and take your bogey like a man. Nowadays, 4,000 Facebook friends will keep your keyboard chattering about fracking, Guantanamo, bigots' parades, modern-day McCarthy's, outsized CEO's pay, or Rachel Corey, mixed in with a dash of the masters. Strive to be a poet of modest renown, taking Kuan Yin over Christ for Christ's sake, happy with cold Momokawa. How you'd say in an interview, you could do the Kevorkian, not so many words, your last poems of the melancholic, but if generosity be love, your love studies paid back abundant. And there'll be stories galore. Maybe the Zen boot camp you ran called a writer's workshop and continued resentment from the dilettante periphery you'd warn about over and over, having felt their wrath. They who'd envy you want a photo with you but not want the 5 a.m. wake-ups and strange languages, or how they'd court the company of dabblers to approximate the feelings of masters, the lifelong shortcuts you refuse to take. In death, you'll be a wise-ass raven above the ferns and moss, urging a poet yet to be with a perfect 7-beat image, then gone, a blur of black in one of 100 avenues of gray across the sky, as we hunkered down for life without that irascible orphan who lived it all as a sacramental relationship that lasts always, always urging us to live as if we'd be measured by stone.
Yes.
So Sam had this technique where he'd take someone's poem and he'd write his own version of it. I wrote a writing exercise called a cover poem. Mm-hmm. So you start with somebody's poem, and instead of talking about palm trees and skyscrapers, maybe you're talking about cedar trees and a lot full of new townhouses or whatever the image might be. And that the template for that poem was Kenneth Rexroth's letter to William Carlos Williams. Mm-hmm. So when Sam realized I was doing that, he said he was happy that I had discovered that trick.
And William Carlos Williams fits in. They knew one another too.
Yeah, they were friends. They both were in the Objectivist issue of Poetry Magazine in 1930, I think it was, although mm-hmm. people don't necessarily see them as Objectivists
anymore. Black Mountain poets, too.
Well, I don't think the Black Mountain... I think the Black Mountain came after the Objectivist anthology. But Rexroth mm-hmm. knew them all, mm-hmm. Certainly. He was friends with Duncan and Spicer, although... probably had their own, right. Difficulties, I'm sure.
Well, that certainly gave a good flavor of some of the habits of Sam Hamill and how well the poet knew some of those traits that were noticed probably by others too. But thank you so much, Paul. This has been Sound Poetry. I've been your host, David Gilmore, and we've heard some fantastic commentary and names that will ring throughout poetic history for many. I appreciate very much, Paul, the way that you read your poems. They're beautiful. People should pick up the 99 Neo-Barocca Haibun de la Serna by Goldfish Press, in the bookstores now. And thanks so much. It was a real pleasure.
Pleasure was mine. Thank you.